The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Blue Cliff Record, Case 98. The monk Tianping Songyi came and stayed at Si Yuan's place for 10 days. Songyi often said, "Don't say that someone who understands the Buddha Dharma seeks someone who can talk about it." Si Yuan heard this, but said nothing. Later, when Songyi went into the Dharma hall to speak, Si Yuan called out to him. Songyi lifted his head. Si Yuan said, "Wrong." Songyi came forward 2 or 3 steps. Si Yuan said, "Wrong." Songyi walked to Si Yuan. Si Yuan said, "These 2 mistakes just now, were they committed by you or by me?" Songyi said, "They were committed by Songyi." Si Yuan said, "Wrong, wrong." Si Yuan then said, "Stay here during the summer period, monk, and I'll discuss these 2 mistakes with you." Songyi wouldn't agree to this. He then left the monastery. Later, when Songyi became the abbot on Mount Tianping, he would always refer to this incident by saying, "When I was on pilgrimage, an evil wind blew me to Ru province. There, an old worthy named Si Yuan tested me. I made 2 mistakes, and he wanted me to remain there for the summer to discuss them. I wouldn't say that I erred at that time. When I set out to travel south, I understood the mistake." Later, Xu San said, "If Songyi had such an understanding, then he didn't see Si Yuan even in his dreams. Why is this? Discuss it." So if you remember yesterday's wonderful talk from Alan, this is a different translation of the same encounter. And one of the things I particularly enjoy about Zen is that we do have an ancestral lineage that supposedly goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha 2,600 years ago. And over all those years, Indian Buddhism turned into Chinese Buddhism, then into Japanese and Korean and Vietnamese Buddhism, and then came to other countries in the United States, in Europe, to what we colloquially call the West, although it's kind of the East, depending on which way your plane is going. But all these chances for misunderstanding, to me, it's like a game of telephone or whisper down the wind, depending on what you grew up with as a child, where one person whispers to another, and then that person whispers to another, and it just keeps going and going and going. And what starts out one way ends up completely different. How can we even know what people of the past said to each other? And all of these stories, of course, are recorded in different places by different people, maybe sometimes people who didn't even live at the time that the characters in this story lived. In fact, we can guarantee that that happened hundreds and hundreds of years later. Many of the stories, 100 of the stories, were compiled into this Hekigan Roku, as we call it in Japanese, the Blue Cliff Record in English. 100 cases of dialogues that ostensibly happened in the past and that are being transmitted accurately to us. Another source for these koans, besides the Blue Cliff Record, is something called the Lamp Records, which were stories that were gathered together by teachers, disciples, and Dharma inheritors later on about the various people. So there is, in fact, in the lamp records, this story about Siyuan Siming. And as Alan said yesterday, we don't know a lot about him. We do know one thing, though, that he lived in the 9th century. We can be pretty sure of that. He was about 40 years older than Tianping, the guy who comes to talk to him. And that both of them were from different lineage traditions. And Siyuan was a grandson in the lineage, not a family grandson, but a Zen ancestor lineage of Lin Ji, the great powerful Zen master whose ancestral lineage came also traced all the way back and goes forward in time to now when we have Rinzai, the Japanese word for Lin Ji, Rinzai descendants of this master who lived over 1,000 years ago. And so Siyuan was a Lin Ji proponent. And Alan and I were talking about this morning. It looks like Tianping was in the Shi To school, which is part of the Soto school. So very different traditions that branched away from each other in China, many, many traditions in China, and Shi To's lineage ended up as our Soto, our modern Soto school. We in Boundless Way trace our inheritance from both sides, from the Korean Rinzai line and also from two different Soto Japanese lines. We mixed them all together and stirred them up and cooked them for many years and came up with what we're doing right now. And here we are, a mixed up conversation between a person from one tradition and a person from another tradition. And as we were saying yesterday, the custom of the time, we're talking about maybe 6th to the 9th century during the Tang Dynasty, was to go on pilgrimage after you've had some kind of an insight. It's not clear whether Tianping was ever a Dharma heir of his teacher. He was considered a disciple of his teacher in all the things we know about him, which, as we said, are infinitesimal. We don't know very much about him. But who, his line died out, and also Siyuan's line died out. So that happens. Maybe our line will die out too. But at the time that they were teaching, they were vigorous teachers, both of them. There are many stories, even though we don't know much about either of them, but many stories and encounters about both of them with their teachers and their students. And the encounters that I looked at are strong. Of course, Siyuan has inherited his dharma from Lin Ji, and so there's shouting and hitting and strong words, and even Tianping is pretty strong in his responses. He's when he finally does have a monastery of his own and teaches and has students, he's unrelenting in his adherence to the dharma. Neither of these teachers, we could say, were being nice to anybody, not in the conventional sense of being cordial or polite or, you know, excuse me and I'm sorry and thank you. They were direct. They were direct because what mattered to them more than anything else, at least as far as I can identify with them, was the Buddha Dharma, the teaching of it, the transmission of it. Any way they could get to people, they would do it. And I really resonate with this. I feel when I first started working with James Ford as my teacher, he commented to me a number of times on how the people in these stories seemed so real to me. And when he gave me my first Roksu, he wrote a long passage from, I think it was from Dogen, which said exactly the same thing, that that you and the ancestors meet heart to heart. And I felt really seen and recognized in that comment because I just have a strong imagination when it comes to stories anyway. which can cause me great harm and also is very entertaining and sometimes gets me through zazens. But ultimately, the stories are inspiring to me, these encounters between people. This one, not so much. Not the most inspiring story I've ever read. I've had to really look deeply into my own heart to understand both of these characters. I love the way Alan helped us to see Tianping, who really comes off, I think Alan used the kind word jerk. I have some other words I could apply to him. But you know, what is going on in the story? They really do not seem to be meeting each other. And that happens, right? Haven't you all and I have had meetings with teachers and students where it's like we're playing Whisper Down the Wind. We just the things we're saying to each other don't meet. We don't understand each other. I loved what Susan said yesterday in the Dharma Dialogue about going from teacher to teacher in Boundless Way. It's like going on a pilgrimage. I'd never thought of that before. And of course, it is. When I first started studying with James Ford, he was the only teacher. And until he gave me transmission and I became a second teacher, the only person you could go to see was him. And he was the Roshi, and that was the way things were. And that's a very common way of teaching Zen. There's just one teacher. They're the authority, and you either like it or you lump it. Hopefully not too actively lumping it. But in Boundless Way, we have two Roshis and two Dharma holders and a number of senior assistant teachers who also do Dokusan. And how wonderful that is, because every encounter gets to be fresh, especially in our daily practice when we're online. You don't know who you're going to get in Doksan. And those of us, and I know maybe that includes everybody, and I certainly used to do this, everybody who plans out your Doksan ahead of time, your hopes are crushed when you actually show up in the room and, oh, I don't think I can say what I meant to say to Alan, to David, and et cetera. It all falls apart. How wonderful that it all falls apart. And there, that may be a little bit of a, an entry point into this koan. Every encounter is a misunderstanding. Every encounter falls apart. There's no way to transmit correctly what's going on in your mind to someone else. These Dharma talks, the Japanese word for them is teisho, and teisho means a demonstration of the shout. And this, of course, is Linji's shout. He would often shout in response to questions. Imagine if we did that these days. Although sometimes I kind of think it would be fun. He would also hit. We really try not to do that. But in our words, we—I say we try to do that. You can ask me about that later. We, in our words, we try to get right to the essential point, just like. The teachers of the past have done, just like I hope the teachers of the future will do. And as I said yesterday, if someone is leaning too far in one direction, we meet them there and either gently or strongly nudge them to the other side. If somebody's really lost in the form world, we meet them in the form world and escort them over time if they're willing. If they really want to stay and work to the emptiness side of things, and vice versa. If some people get caught in emptiness, we have to bring them back to the form world. And it goes back and forth and back and forth for a while. But ultimately, the fruit of this practice, in my opinion, is a complete connecting with our own heart, mind, and finding that there is no form versus emptiness. There's no emptiness versus form. There's just this moment arising as it arises, including everything. Everything is the Buddha Dharma. We read earlier in our sutra service a piece from Dogen, from his wonderful Genjo Koan, which has many translations as well. The Way of Everyday Life is my favorite translation. I think in this book, we now call it Actualizing Fundamental Reality. Koan, meaning something like what it means to us, but also going into the way things actually are, going into our life as it actually is. And Dogen says this whole thing about fish and birds, that fish fly and birds swim. And I'm sorry, I got that mixed up. That's a kind of inspirational thing for me. Anyway, fish swim, I hope, and birds fly. Of course, in the emptiness realm and the thusness realm, it is reversed, but that's a matter for another talk. But the bird flies in the sky and it never finds an end to the air. And the fish swims and it never finds an end to the water. And later he says, life is the bird and life is the fish. Water is life, air is life. These are things that Dogen tends to do. He just takes out words and rearranges them. And it can feel really confusing, but I think it's his way of meeting this issue that we all have with communication. I've been reading a lot of his works over the last few months, just one or two at a time. And he does it again and again and again. And it shakes up the whisper down the wind tendency. It's like we're trying to think, what is he saying? And I don't know what he's saying. He's writing in 12th century, 13th century Japanese anyway, and he's making up words in Japanese, and then we're reading a translation of a translation of a translation. Who knows what he actually said? But anyway, some of these translators are quite poetic, and it's inspiring, and it's lovely. He says that if a bird wishes to fly or a fish wishes to swim, only after investigating the whole sky or the whole sea, this bird or this fish will find neither path nor place. So taking that along with the advice we were giving yesterday to do this wandering practice, to wander from teacher to teacher, even within Boundless Way, to keep searching, to find, as Brad said, the cozy place, the place that feels like home, the place that feels like you're in alignment with it. And the forms that feel like you're in alignment with, and the teachings that feel like you're in alignment with them, to really explore, but then not keep going to think that you will find something and that will be it. It'll be over. It's not really what we're doing here. Dogen goes on to say, when you find your place where you are, practice enlightenment, which is a word he made up, that the practice is the same as awakening. And we say it in English, practice with a hyphen, practice enlightenment occurs. He says, when you find your way at this moment, you become actualized reality for the place. The way is neither large nor small, neither yours nor others. The place, the way, has not carried over from the past, and it is not merely arising now. He's pointing to a way of being in the world that actualizes thusness, presence, right here, right now. Everything that's arising in your mind, in your body, in your cognitive brain, the smells and the feelings of the air and the sunlight, at least in Worcester, coming through the windows. All of this is your path and your place right now. There's nowhere else to go until you take a step and find yourself somewhere else. But you'll never reach the end of the air or the end of the water or the end of this practice enlightenment, this awakening right now. And yet we get caught, don't we? And this is, of course, what the koan is pointing to. We get caught all the time. I'm still resonating with Alan yesterday, stopping at the point in the koan where Si Yuan invites Tianping to stay with him. And in this translation, which is by Andy Ferguson from the Lamp Records, Sun Yi wouldn't agree to this. How often does this happen? We make an offering, we make a gesture of invitation, and people say, no, I don't think so, not for me right now. No, I gotta wait a little longer, see ya. We respect this because sometimes accepting the invitation isn't correct in the moment. I read another translation of this that comes from, and I can't remember the guy's name, but the very first translation of the Blue Cliff Record into English from Japanese by a man who was a scholar, not a practitioner. He thought that both of these characters were wrong. He has a little lecture in the book where he says that neither of them understood the great matter. For Siyuan to keep saying wrong, wrong, was not understanding, and for Tianping to turn away was not understanding. But we could look at this from a different perspective. We could say that maybe they were both right. Not a right that's the opposite of wrong, but aligned with their own hearts. Siyuan is someone who encounters this person who comes on pilgrimage from another tradition in Zen, another lineage, and he meets him in this translation. He really makes a great effort. I think you can dig that out of our Boundless Way translation too, but here it's very explicit to me. Tianping says, don't say that someone who understands the Buddha Dharma seeks someone who can talk about it. That's a little bit of a different translation of what we think he may have said. But he's basically, to me, saying, it can't be talked about. I'm on pilgrimage, but I'm not looking for teachings, which is an interesting attitude, but maybe not spoken teachings. Maybe he just wants to encounter all these different teachers in the flesh and meet them directly. That would be my hope for all students who come to me. They want the direct meeting, and nobody knows how to do that. The only thing we've been trained to do since childhood is to use words, maybe to shake hands. In our inherited tradition from Asia, we bow to each other. But beyond that, where do we really meet? How do we really meet? What is the true meeting between people? Siyan first meets that statement with silence in this version of the story. And then Tianping goes into the Dharma hall to speak, and Xian calls out to him. And Song Yi, Tianping, lifts up his head. What's wrong with that? Wouldn't we all do that? If our names were called, we'd lift up our heads. But Siyuan says wrong. What is he saying wrong to? What does he mean by his wrong? It's a little bit like Zhao Zhou when he encounters the monk in our, you might say, central koan of Mu, the monk who sincerely wants to know if dogs have the Buddha nature, when the teaching he's heard all his life is everything has the Buddha nature. So maybe he's not talking about dogs, right? Maybe he's talking about his own doubts about himself. Do I have the Buddha nature? Can I ever wake up to the truth of reality? Does Zhao Zhou say, of course you can, honey pie? No. He says, essentially, another word for wrong. Mu or wu in Chinese, which means not or non. It's a negation. What is Zhao Zhou negating? And what is Xi Yuan negating? I might point you here towards an idea that what's being negated is our old habit patterns of understanding that have forever and forever as we said in the Bodhisattva's vow, again and again and again, brought us so much suffering. We know this so well. Anybody who's sat more than 10 minutes knows how the mind intrudes and begins generating all of the old stories, often about the self, sometimes about other people, sometimes about the way life is. Over and over again, over and over again, we hurt ourselves. So Zhao Zhou and Shi Yuan, in their great kindness, say, "No, wrong." Sometimes teachers say, "Hey," sometimes they shout, sometimes they knock their stick on the ground, and in the old days, knock their stick on the heads of their students. Whatever we can do to interrupt this, it's so important. We don't want to dwell in the land of made-up fantasies about the meaning of life. We want to, I want to encounter it directly. So more wrongs, he walks and it's wrong and he walks over. And then there's the invitation, stay with me. Stay with me. Don't go away. Don't leave. Stay, 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 stay with yourself. Stay with this practice. Stay with the things that you don't understand, that torment you, that also make you happy, make you want to dance. Stay with them until they clarify for you. Stay for the 3-month summer period in this case. Stay at the sesshin, stay in Doksan, stay at your job, cleaning the bathroom again and again and again, washing the rice again and again and again, each time as if for the first time, if we are directly encountering life in this way. And then this whole thing that happens at the end, I just want to say a few words about it. Because this translation pops up in some of the other translations of koans in the Blue Cliff Record. It looks like every translator picked and chose different parts of it. This seems to be the source of a lot of that stuff. Tianping is now an abbot on Mount Tianping, which is where he gets his name. And it says in this translation, he would always refer to this incident by saying, "When I was on pilgrimage, an evil wind blew me to Ru province." That's where Shi Yuan lived. An evil wind. There he is again, making good and bad, good and evil, right and wrong. What's he pointing to? If we can look at him also as an accomplished teacher and not just a grown-up jerk, what is he really saying? And he refers to Siyuan as an old worthy. And he says he was tested by him. And he says that he made two mistakes. And that Siyuan wanted him to stay to discuss them. "And I'm not saying," he says, "that I made a mistake at that time by leaving." Which is interesting. He's not saying I made a mistake, and he's not saying I didn't make a mistake. He's just saying I wouldn't say that I made a mistake at that time. But when I set out to travel south, when I left him, I understood the mistake. I understood what I was doing. And then years later, he tells this story again and again and again. In our translation, it says he stopped saying wrong, or that was the last time he said wrong. And that's pointing to something similar to this. I understood. I saw something. Not by staying, but by leaving. Does it even matter? One foot follows the other into something that we can begin to understand. And then this other teacher, Shushan, who lived 100 years later, makes a comment that's not part of the Blue Cliff Record, where he's really putting down Tianping. He says if he didn't understand what Siyuan was saying to him, he didn't meet him, even in a dream. This is a common insult that Zen masters say about people. You don't even understand this in a dream. Well, aren't we all dreaming? And when will we wake up? And how is it that we keep encountering each other and missing the fundamental point? How is it that that happens? The faint sound of birdsong outside as the birds start to return in the winter sun is telling you the answer. The world is offering itself to you at every moment. There's no confusion. Just this. Find your path and your place. Find what it Dogen means by awakening and practice being one thing. Be carried away by your life right to this place, this path. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and we'll form our semicircle in the Zendo. And I'll go back and forth between the Zoom Zendo and the Zendo that I'm sitting in right now. And you know what to do on Zoom. Raise your hand, please, and raise your physical hand in the Zendo. And Alan and David and I will do our best to meet you. Yes, Jenny, I think we need that microphone. Oh, okay. Yeah, well, then you won't be able to answer it, but that's okay.
Go ahead. I'll hand it back.
Oh.
So in yesterday's translation, I really noticed the by chance, that by chance I went to this guy and he told me the wrongs. And I took the by chance at first as like, I didn't really want to see this guy. I just needed rice and a place to sleep. He was there. That was the price. And then later I took the by chance as like, wow, I wasn't looking for that, but it really changed me. And then today I was listening for that. What's it going to say instead of by chance? And it was an evil wind. Wind blew me there. So it's,
yeah, and actually a lot of the translations don't say evil wind. They say I was blown there. The wind is a big deal in all the translations. That must have been an original word in the Chinese.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, it's 10 days is a long time to
right.
stay someplace.
You stayed 10 days,
yeah.
In this version.
Yeah.
It is.
So it's just the rejecting and the, I don't need this, I know what I need. I don't know. And then the meeting, and when I have to, like, I want to meet, but I have to run away. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you, Jenny.
Yeah, just appreciating the stories we tell about our life, and we think we know why we're someplace, or we think, oh, I chose this, or I didn't choose this. And I love all the different permutations you're noticing about those stories. And as I consider it, it does seem to me that our lives we are blown about. All of the karmic winds, all of the things that happen to you and to people you care about. And we control so very little. Each of us has been blown here. And you may think this is a wonderful thing that you've been blown here. You may think that it's a terrible thing. You may go back and forth, in breath, out breath. But here we are. And here is the way. And what a beneficent universe to blow us around like this.
Thank you, goodness. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Marla.
Thank you. I really enjoyed both talks yesterday and today, but Jenny's comment and then David's comment really kind of finally hit me with something. Yesterday, it was the first time I heard the koan, and I felt like, well, that's a long koan. But today, I feel like there's really strong personal application, and that is the sometimes you don't know how you've gotten somewhere or why, or you don't really know what you want. And that's one of my personal life koans. I think I'm making the mistake of thinking that sometimes there is one thing. There's one thing I want. Yeah. There's one thing I think. And that variation is wrong. And, you know, maybe it's just a matter of karma or whatever. And sometimes there are two things I sort of want, or I can't tell, or I ping pong. And that's just part of the journey. It's part of, you know, part of the, that's part of the koan, and it's okay. So this has been tremendously helpful for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, you know, you're lucky that you only have two things.
Oh yeah, sometimes it's four, but
well, even so, just there's so much we don't know about what's going to unfold. If I look back at everything that happened that led me to this place, I could make a kind of narrow line, but looking into the future, it's a vast, I just don't know. So yeah, there it is a wind that blows us around, as Jenny and David were saying.
Yeah, I wanted to put the two comments together too, because I'm struck by this evil wind. And you know, I'm thinking of the old proverb, it's an ill wind that blows nobody some good. So so you can be blown into a bad place, but fine.
It's hard for us to hear in the Zoom room.
Oh, sorry, somebody turned us off.
It wasn't on, sorry.
Yeah, now it's on. So they do this to me all the time. And they never tell me about the blue tape. So just that it's an ill wind that blows nobody some good. So you can find yourself in the wrong place and yet find something that you need, along with a lot of stuff that you don't need and that you don't want. It's this building on Marla's point that it's not one thing. It's not the way he starts the story. It's as though, and then everything, you know, was terrible, but it's not necessarily where he ends up.
This thing that arises for all of us, and you hear people say, well, I don't need this, right? I don't need this. But yet, of course, everything we encounter is our karma, is our life. We can say, I don't like this. I wish it were different. But this is the, we're practicing this great necessity of life, of what is here is here. This is the path. This is the way. And apparently I do need this. Here it is.
Thank you. Somebody in the, we've got, let's start with Chad and we'll get to you, Ann.
It's on. Thank you.
Blue tape switch up.
I think it's on. Thank you both for the talks, because I've been contemplating this since yesterday, and I feel like sometimes I approach these with naive optimism, and so what I heard was a lot of compassion. Mm-hmm. The teachers knowing exactly what this person needs to kind of ring the bell and, you know, wake them up a little, even if I couldn't hear it at that time, and then I take it away. And then it sort of felt like there was some humor to it, like, and especially reinforced today with the evil wind. To me, that was more like, oh, it was an evil wind. You know, I didn't want it at the time, but wow, look what I learned.
Yeah, right? I see it that way too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chip. Yeah, I mean, just this is a wonderful theme that we're opening up here about what we call karma. You know, that we can think that we choose things and think we know what's best for us, but there's some neurological evidence that we never choose anything. We're just constantly, you know, even holding up a hand, the hand went up and then the mind came in and said, put up your hand. I can't get my mind around that. But so there's this sort of simultaneous unfolding of karma, and we go with it in a way. Rather, and so I agree with you. I'm really happy you said it, Chad. I think that Tianping was making a very big, funny comment. Right? Yeah, evil wind brought me here to be with you in the Sendo right now. Yeah, so lucky, huh? Thank you. Yeah, Esther.
Yeah, so right now I'm sitting both with the impression of Michael's talk last night when he began it by speaking about being in the wrong, so many times more than we'd like to admit, and not necessarily, that's how I received it, embracing how we dealt with it or were with it. And then this thread through the other talks too about staying for a whole summer's retreat and exploring these places. And so as I've been sitting and listening and resonating and heart responding and mind responding, and there's something about the whole wrong and right releasing in some way. And there's something about these places of, you know, perhaps just adding other words, but places of suffering or places of possible waking up to something. How is it that we meet or don't meet? Sometimes staying, sometimes not. And the regret we sometimes feel looking back at life, and but practicing courage and noticing these places. The staying invitation is so helpful and so difficult sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah, and I wanted to pick up where you ended up. I wanted to pick up where you began, Esther, on this, you know, idea of wrong after wrong, and not, you know, not wanting to be wrong. And something that's been coming up for me with this koan is something I learned late, which was better than never as a teacher, which is that sometimes I found I had to tell students they were wrong, or we would just be stuck. And students hated that until I learned to say, the first time I did that, if you're never wrong, you can't learn anything. So it's actually wonderful to be wrong. It's, you've just done a service for all of us by being wrong. And I've been wondering if that's the case with this koan, right? That it was a gift for him to be wrong, because it opened up some possibility for him. And yet the other part of me wants to think that the whole right wrong dichotomy is what's wrong. And so I'm just putting that out there as a response to you. Was the point to get past right and wrong, or was the point to be wrong?
I love that you said that. That helps me find a way in as well to what Esther was saying. What came up for me was another koan that we decided not to do, but it's very similar, where a student comes to somebody and the teacher says, wrong, wrong. And then the teacher goes to somebody else, and the student goes to somebody else, and the teacher says, right, right. And the student says, well, wait a minute, so-and-so said wrong, wrong, you're saying right, right. Or maybe it's the other way around, doesn't even matter. At a certain point, both right and wrong fall away, and we see thusness, which is what I think we're trying to point to here. Yeah. So thank you. So Anne had her hand up before. Do you still want to speak?
Yeah.
I'll try to remember you.
I've often been taken by, I've liked the translation Alan used. I've often been taken by how much we give away about ourselves without knowing and without speaking, and that this person could see it from far away. And you know that's happened to you, both people recognizing something in you and you recognizing something in them without any words being said.
Yeah. Yeah.
I appreciate you bringing that up, Anne, because all of us, of course, are aware on some degree of how am I coming across, and we kind of curate ourselves and try to present the good stuff that we think is good and try to keep the other stuff in the closet. But we're all giving ourselves away at every moment. And while that is terrifying, isn't it what we want? We long to be ourselves. We long to be seen, and we run away from it. Oh, you know, go tearing off the other direction. What if people really knew? And the news is people already know, right? I guess, you know, good news and bad news. But the other night here in the Dharma Dialogue on Thursday, someone was saying how scary it is to come forward as ourselves, partly because we're deluded to think that we're hiding. and maybe realizing, oh, yeah, sorry, no hiding. We can do this courage that has come up, be the courage, wrong, right, yes, both, everything. And how sweet it is, you know, when we truly see another human being, for me at least, I can't help but fall in love, right, with the whole thing, not with just the good part, but with the incredible struggle and courage that every person brings, and the great Dharma light that each person is fully revealed. Yeah.
Thank you. Susan.
So in this moment, I feel completely lost. And as well during the talk, which was definitely very, very, very relevant for my current situation and what I'm carrying with me. But it was like, oh, there was nothing I could hold on to. And I have a story I'm telling myself. It's an old story. So when you said, Melissa, in terms of some teachers, that they are very, I don't know what kind of words you were using, but very straight and very direct. I experiencing this as painful. I experiencing this really as this is harm for me. And I'm struggling with that. And there is as well, I notice a judgment I have. And even in this space, just right now, although in general I feel really, really safe to say things in the Sangha, in the group, I'm hesitant to say what I'm thinking, because there is a sense of it's not okay to voice this. There is danger to voice it. How will I be perceived or so? And this is where I am just right now, but at least I made the step to voice this.
Yeah.
Just right now, Dan.
Susan, I appreciate this. And this is a demonstration of this stepping forward without knowing. And I think when we come forward authentically, there can be no knowing. And to say that, so these encounters with teachers may seem quite romantic and beautiful. In actual fact, our encounters with our teachers, with our Zen teachers, and with our friends and family can be quite painful. And when someone says wrong, it can touch such a deep place in us. We spoke just a little bit about shame last time. We can just, and how dare you touch that? If you cared about me, you wouldn't touch that place in me. You would protect me. And so this is risky business. And feeling really hurt, genuinely hurt, is something that I guarantee will happen wherever you go. There is no place to avoid that. But for me, in this context of relationship over time, in this context of Sangha, and this work we're doing together, hopefully we can bear it if it's right for us. Sometimes it's not right and we have to say too much. No one can know that but you. But this is part of what is happening here. Please don't feel safe here. Thank you.
Maren, did you hear him?
Thank you. Been thinking a lot about the right and wrong, the going, the staying for retreat. I've really appreciated the talks from last night and today and the people's comments. And it also comes back to your comment about, do dogs have Buddha nature? And just sort of setting that into, again, the right, wrong, going, staying, do I have Buddha nature? And another place that comes up again for me as well is sitting with our meal service in that line where it says, am I worthy to eat this?
Mm-hmm. Well, that question, you know, was asked by a monk sometime in the 7th century, right? And it resonates through the years. Am I good enough? Can I? And, you know, and the answer, of course you are. It's hard to believe because fighting that answer is so much of these old stories, you know, whatever they are about, we all have them. And so these undoing, the teacher undoing that delusive story is, as Susan said, it can be quite painful. Really hurts to be shown that we're off base in some way. So I think that asking yourself that question again and again and again and watching what arises in response to it and then challenging that, you know, just seeing that as an old mind pattern. You know, I'm not safe, I'm not worthy, I'm no good, I'm a screw up. Is there anybody in the room who doesn't think that way ever? I mean, I think we all think that way. So I might be wrong. but that direct meeting, right, that Anne was talking about, we have to be ready to be fully exposed, as they say, as David was pointing to, fully exposed. And some of us are willing to risk it, and some of us it's just too much. And that doesn't mean that's wrong, right? We all have our own life trajectory around revealing our hearts. Oh, and I did want to say one thing, but I know Alan wants to say something. David, when you said that you fall in love with students, you know, I actually had a little.
The truth is out. David's in love with everyone.
Well, because my first teacher used to say that, and he acted on it, and he had sexual relationships with students, and he tried to have one with me, and it was why I left him. You know, this is why we have the forms. If you're ever wondering, we have boundaries, we have precepts. It's the love is so strong for all of you. It's so strong. I sometimes I can't stand it. It's so strong. And I have taken a vow not to act on any of it, not to be inappropriate. So I just wanted to reassure everybody that because of what we've lived through mm-hmm. with our teachers, not James Ford, by the way, we're to hold that love appropriately and then feel it returned. That is an amazing thing. And it can be returned just in a smile or just in a passing somebody on the way to the kitchen. Like, it's not a big deal. So I just did want to say that, you know, and we are married to each other, if you don't know that. So, but.
So I just wanted to go back to what that moment in the meal service that you were referring to, Maren, because it's a moment that's really important for me. And also what's important to me is the line before that. You know, we reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us, because eating is in some ways the most egocentric thing we do, you know, like as in eat or be eaten, you know, this is the assertion of the self. And so at that moment, we're asked to actually think about all of the ways that the food came to us, including the creatures that had to die. You know, you don't have to be a meat eater to be responsible for a lot of death when you eat. So anytime we eat, we're eating because something else has died so that we could live. And so it's a really profound moment in the meal service where instead of like, great, now I can eat something, we're asked to say, wow, you know, look at this whole interpenetrating world that's led for me to be able to eat. And then, you know, we reflect on our virtue and practice and whether we're worthy of this offering. You know, who am I to be the one who consumes when others lose, the one who lives when others die? And so I'm just encouraging you to think of it that way too. Not so much am I worthy, but are any of us worthy? What does it mean for any of us to eat in a world where eating means killing?
Thank you. I don't know if Madhu is still with us, but you had your hand up yesterday and today and put it down. Are you there, Madhu?
Yeah. I've been contemplating whether to speak or not, but, you know, I just wanted to support Susan in what she said. I also strongly felt the pain. It was, you know, the misunderstanding between two human beings. This is my lifelong koan, and this is a very difficult area for me. And it just breaks my heart when two people go their different ways and they carry misunderstanding with them. It's very hard. So the pain was the strongest for me. And the right or the wrong didn't even touch me that much, or I didn't go with either the right or the wrong as much. But I sincerely believe that every person, every human being has the right to voice even their wrongs, just like me right now.
Yeah.
Even if it's wrong, I feel like they need to say it sometimes. And that also has to be heard by everybody. And I might be very wrong in saying this, but I just wanted to say that.
You might be very what, saying this?
Wrong.
Oh, wrong? Yeah. But, you know, I want to say right or wrong. This is what a Dharma dialogue is for, right? Dokusan is a private Dharma dialogue. But here, the whole Sangha listens in. And we do get to do what you're doing right now, Madhu. We do get to come forward and say what touches us, because I feel like that's what you're saying right now. It reminds me of what Matt was saying yesterday. You know, he saw the koan in a particular way that was illuminating for us. And Susan's comment yesterday about the pilgrimage. I mean, this is, we come forward with our own, not intellectual insights, but what really touches us. And this really, this pain of miscommunication between these two characters really touched you. And you just expressed it, which is a gift to everyone. Thank you. So yeah, let's take just a couple more. How about Bix? And then we'll get, I think, to Will maybe.
Thank you for the talk. A lot of what's being said is touching me, especially this idea of misunderstanding, which I didn't even think of when it came to the koan, because there's a lot of people who I've had misunderstandings with in my past, and like I just want to love them, but you just can't. Anyway, what I wanted to bring up was something that touched me was this the sort of blowing in the wind, and how none of this is sort of in our control. And that's kind of reassuring for me, because on one hand, it's like, okay, I guess I'll just, you know, wait here to get enlightened. Like, and then on the other and then on the other hand, it's like, okay, cool. I don't really have to do anything. I can just like do the practice, and like that will happen or it won't. And it's another thing that's coming to mind is sort of just like, you can't, or I can't control when that like one little sound that I hear, or one little thing that a teacher says, is going to like really touch me and penetrate me, and so I don't have to like on the koan so hard, and I can just like chill out a little bit.
Bix, you have already been touched. You have given so much of your life already, traveling here and there, coming back here again and again. Something has, the switch has already been flipped, and your participation, continued participation, is required, right? Do nothing. And I love this. You're just noticing what's coming up, and this possibility, maybe to take it a little easier. This is the time. Now is the path. These are the good old days. 20 years from now, you'll look back and think, oh, that was so lovely. Right? And here it is. Thank you for speaking up.
Thank you. And I think we'll just take two more, Pierce, and then Will, and we'll end. So go ahead, Pierce.
Thank you. Thanks for the talk, Melissa. As I was sitting here listening to the comments, I noticed that I am trying to formulate a rule of thumb. I really can't believe I'm doing this, but in regard to koan work and in regard to right and wrong. And I appreciated also what Alan said about, you know, is the point to get beyond right or wrong, or to discover what is wrong and right for you in the moment. And as I was sitting here, I remembered a little anecdote from my past life before I came to Zen, where I was working in a group of people, a community, and we were thinking about inviting a teacher with whom I had a special relationship. And I went ahead and invited him. What the hell? And so then at the next community meeting, they were raking me over the coals for doing that without consulting the community. And so one of the people said to me, do you acknowledge that you shouldn't have done this? And I said, yes, of course. And he said, if you had it to do over, what would you do? And I said, I'd probably do just the same thing. And he said, good.
Wonderful. Thank you for that, Pierce. And last, the microphone will come to Will.
Thanks. I don't know. I feel maybe this is a little too heavy to come last, but so I'm thinking about situations that, you know, you can find yourself in where you're pretty sure something's wrong, but you're not don't know what to do about it, or, you know, it's very difficult to handle. And I think if it's okay, I'll actually just say concretely what I'm thinking of, because the specifics make it a little clearer. So I was married for 36 years to a guy who was an addict. Usually the the story is, well, you know, at some point you just have to say, well, yes, I love you, but, and I suppose that's exactly what happened, finally. But that was 36 years. We met when we were 19, and it's most of my life. And I still love him because I can't not, right? We're sort of woven together. But there is this sort of tremendous feeling of, wow, did I really screw that up? Because look, I stayed with him through horrible, really horrible time. What was I doing? And, you know, so, and the reason I'm asking is not just about the past, but in another somewhat lighter way, but still problematic. I find myself now in a situation where I think, all right, some things are not right, but I'm not sure whether it's like I should leave or I should go in and fix, or, and then I think, wow, you know, maybe this is me repeating a pattern of getting stuck in this, don't know what to do, can't do it. And then, you know, will I feel later on like, you know, it was all like, I just kept making mistakes. And, you know, I think that probably the answer is that, or, you know, to get a little headspace where there's a little more curiosity about the situation, rather than this kind of enumeration. Well, this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, but on the other hand, this is right, this is right. But I guess I just wonder, when we're talking no right, no wrong, it is possible to end up in situations that you really do need to get out of. And I'm sort of wondering where to place that thought.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in a way you already touched on this. Well, you were answering your own question. But just to make it more pointed, you know, we are going to repeat patterns. That's what human beings do. And then you said, well, you know, in effect, as I repeat it, can I do it with a little bit more curiosity and with a little bit, you know, and you know, yeah, and really looking into it. And so we don't have to repeat them in the same way. You know, it's the difference between a rut and some kind of movement that cycles up. Yeah, spiral. Thank you. That was the word I wanted.
Well, right. You know, I agree with what Alan's saying. And, you know, I could think of times in my life. I already just spoke about one of them. Yeah. I stayed with that teacher for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think I learned so much from him. I also learned so much from the situation. And I loved him. And, you know, he was my first teacher. All that. Very positive, very negative. I don't get it. Right, wrong. And I stayed. And what does that say about me? It is both good and bad, mm-hmm. right? There's something in you that one of your behavioral patterns is to you stay with your commitments, right? And another one is that if you're anything like me, you ignore some data that may be saying no, get out of here. And I don't think any of that is bad. I don't. I think that. 36 years you were married? Mm-hmm. Those were 36 lives of a fox, as we say mm-hmm. in Zen, right? Everything that we've done is what we've done. And now we're here. And it doesn't mean we're going to stop doing it. You know, the fruit of practice that Alan was just pointing to is that maybe we can do it with a little more attention and openness as we repeat these patterns. And maybe not. Maybe we'll make an even worse mistake next time. And, you know, right?
Don't do the good old days.
Boy, remember when you, my ex-husband, was the worst thing about my life? Oh, and that's kind of the thing, right? That's kind of the thing. It's this. Here is the place. Here the path unfolds.
Or maybe the other thing, that there are times when the karmic thing shifts, mm-hmm. right? Things drop away, and not because you worked hard and hard and hard, but I guess I needed to do this until I didn't need to do it.
Exactly. Huh.
And I guess now was the time.
Yeah.
And I wished it were, you know, 33 years ago, but you know, we live our life.
And it's because we don't have control over everything.
Yeah.
That when the moment of, really, that's a moment of awakening that David's pointing out, appears, we can go, oh, and if we get caught in the pattern of, why didn't I see this before? That then we get sucked back into the whirlwind. Yeah. Thank you. Glad that was our last comment. Perfect. Thank you, everyone. Please get back into your seats.